Hello again, Mark Godfrey here, and we are balls deep at Italia 90, at episode 9 of Vincerà already. And boy, do we have a lot to talk about on today's show as we look back at June 16th of this magnificent tournament. It was the day Scotland had to win to avenge their embarrassment against Costa Rica. England and Holland met with neither in particularly good shape after their stuttering opening matches. And it was the last full day at number one in the UK music charts for a certain World Cup anthem. With me to pick over the bones of this lot, I'm joined by Simon Hart, author of World in Motion, the inside story of Italia 90. Nice to have you back again, Simon. How are you doing?
Yeah, fine, thanks. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Making his Vincerà debut today is David Hartrick, the main man at Ockley Books, and a former editor of the brilliant In Bed with Maradona website. Welcome, Dave. How are you doing?
Excellent. Very excited.
Great. Pleased to have you here. And finally, another first-timer, but ready to take us by storm, is Webby, not his real name, obviously, from the Football and Music website, and he's also a contributor to the excellent book Football Disco. How's it going, Webby?
Hello, great, lovely to be here.
Fantastic. Okay, guys, let's get stuck into this then, and we'll start with the matches from June 16th. First up, it's to Turin Stadio degli Alpi, and the carnival atmosphere for Brazil versus Costa Rica. The Group C winners from the first games were looking to seal qualification here. Costa Rica, unusually, were wearing Juventus colours of black and white stripes, blatantly playing to the crowd sympathies as many locals would be rooting for the underdogs? Well, no. The answer actually lies back in Episode 7, thanks to Doug Beaton of Classic Football Shirts. It was, in fact, in homage to Libertad, Costa Rica's oldest club, who'd recently gone out of business back home. Well, watching the highlights, Costa Rica were never really in it, and how the final score was only 1-0 is an absolute mystery. Brazil obviously didn't believe Luis Canejo's performance in goal against Scotland was a true reflection of his ability, because they peppered his goal from long range and especially targeted him and the central defenders from crosses and corners. Brazil looked likely to score at each opportunity, and there were plenty of those, weren't there, lads?
Loads. They nearly score so many Brazil-type goals, don't they? A couple of free kicks, there's a volley, there's a couple of swerving shots from 25 yards. I can't remember who it is, but somebody goes on a run and tries to finish with the outside of their foot, but just doesn't go in, and they scored perhaps a completely un-Brazilian goal, didn't they? I think it possibly takes two deflections.
Yeah, it was a bit of a harum-scarum first half. Really, you had Brazil absolutely just, you know, pouring forward, and that goal, as you said, came courtesy of Muller, which was a decent enough finish, wasn't it? But yeah, you're right, it took at least one deflection along the way. That Brazil didn't win by a bigger margin than just that single goal. Does that indicate Costa Rica were riding their luck to the maximum, a lack of focus and or belief, or all of the above? Simon, what do you think?
Probably a little bit of both. I mean, Costa Rica did have the, a very good goalkeeper, Conejo, who he was one of the two goalies in FIFA squad of the tournament at the end of it. So he obviously did something right that tournament. He'd frustrated Scotland in the previous game. As for Brazil, they ended that World Cup with four goals in four games. So something wasn't quite right there. And Lazzaroni, the coach, is obviously down on the list of least fondly remembered Brazil, World Cup managers of all time, really. It wasn't a great Brazil team, really, was it? For the tactics wasn't quite, they'd changed since that 82 team who everybody loved, and they'd become a little bit more pragmatic.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they'd shown some elements of what you'd expect from Brazilians in terms of flair. But they were certainly between phases, weren't they? That the excellent 82 to 86 team of the likes of Socrates and Zico, Falcao, they were all but done and gone, while the team that would go on to win the World Cup in 1994 was just beginning to take shape with Bebeto and Romario were on the bench here, and the likes of Dunga and a few others were already in that squad, but hadn't quite established themselves, and as you say, that they hadn't picked the right coach, as pretty obvious by what you said and how they performed throughout the tournament here. We'll touch on Brazil and some of their players later in the series, but for now they were safely through, and Costa Rica was still in with a great shout, with a lacklustre Sweden up next for them. A point would probably see them through too. A real key match in Group C this, another elimination battle really between Scotland and Sweden. The Scots had to at least save some face after the Costa Rica debacle in the same arena in Genoa. Coach Andy Roxburgh made several changes. Out were Goff, McStay, Bett and McAnally. In were Levine, Fleck, McLeod and Jury. While Sweden welcomed back their captain, Liverpool's Glenn Hussein, to the defence after he missed their opening defeat to Brazil. There were plenty of Scottish fans in attendance and there was a nice early goal to settle their nerves. Guys, talk us through this first goal by Scotland.
It's a goal made in the UK, isn't it? Corner, near post flick, lunge, goal.
Yeah, hardly the kind of flair we'd maybe come to expect from a few of the other teams, you're right. But they certainly needed a second goal, which actually didn't come till 10 minutes from the end of the game, when Mo Johnson's penalty sent Thomas Ravelli the wrong way, and it gave Scotland some much-needed breathing room. And, you know, they ended up really needing it, didn't they? Sweden had a bit of a late rally.
Yeah, I mean, that game was... It was like a cup final, really, for both teams. And I think afterwards, the Sweden coach said to Andy Roxburgh, you know, we killed each other here, because they... excuse me, they both put sandwich into that. Into, you mentioned the British-type... type goal, you know, for the opening goal from the corner, but it was a British type game. So yeah, and then in a British type game, you know, teams keep on going to the very end, as the Swedes did.
Do we all think that was a dive for the penalty, by the way? Because the way he runs across, it's certainly an exaggerated fall from Roy Aitken, in my humble opinion.
Oh, British players didn't dive back in those days, come on.
No, of course not, of course not.
Well, nothing's ever easy with Scotland. They held on, even accounting for that late Swedish goal and push for an equaliser at the end. But they did get the 2 points, which gave them hope of going where they'd never gone before or since, the knockout stages of the World Cup finals. Only Brazil standing in their ways in their way, though, and I'm really looking forward to that episode. England, and particularly manager Bobby Robson, were under immense pressure after a terrible display in the 1-1 draw with Ireland. The knives were not only out for Bobby, but were being well and truly thrust into both his back and front since before Italia 90 even began. The team were hardly speaking to the press either, and the siege mentality had certainly taken root. Not that things were much better for Holland and coach Leo Beenhakker, after their own drab draw with Egypt, possibly a worse result than England's on the face of it. But they were still European champions with the AC Milan triumvirate and Ronald Koeman enough to put the fear of God into most opponents. And don't forget, they had battered England at Euro 88. Shall we start out, guys, by talking about Bobby Robson and the absolute vilification he received from some sections of the English media. Firstly, they cast him as a traitor for agreeing to join PSV Eindhoven immediately after Italia 90. But that isn't the full story of that, is it?
No, I mean, when I spoke to Lady Elsie Robson, you know, Sir Bobby's late wife, she said that Bobby simply wasn't offered a new contract by the FA. At the time, I think there were some reports that Bert Millerchip had said to Bobby Robson, you know, you can have a new contract if you win the World Cup, which some might say was the same as not offering him a new contract at all, given, you know, England's prospects going into that tournament. So yeah, I mean, really curious, you know, from a distance of 30 years, that manager doesn't get offered a new contract and looks for another job and is vilified.
And I think it's worth saying he'd had 2 years of basically the tabloid newspapers full on in a circulation war, and they had realised that kicking the England team was a very effective way to sell papers. And he had the treatment he'd received, when you look back on it, it's absolutely shocking, some of the articles that were written. It really is pretty by modern standards. We have so much, you know, there's so many words written about football that it's quite shocking to see something so focused on, quite frankly, being pretty nasty, and it all directed towards one man. And England were not great in the run-up to Italia 90, and the FA made some poor decisions, like sending them on the to the friendly in Saudi Arabia, etc. But, you know, the back page headlines like, in the name of Allah, please go, etc. It is quite shocking looking back at that. And it's, he didn't get offered a new contract, basically, because I think the FA felt the pressure, didn't they, from the press more than anywhere else.
Well, the atmosphere around Robson was toxic, and by and large, he was a gentleman, someone who belonged to another era, really. He struggled to grasp the modern tabloid approach to analysing him and the England team, and he was largely able to maintain his dignity throughout the vitriol that came his way, although he did lose his rag before and during Italian 90 with the press. And it's, but I mean, I think it went and actually galvanised the players and got them behind him rather than maybe the opposite, which could have happened based on, as we said, some of the pre-tournament performances in the friendlies. Would you agree about that? Do you think actually this whole, you know, what a lot of managers do now by fostering this siege mentality spirit, it really did work, didn't it? Even from that first game onwards, when they played poorly against Ireland, but and the storm that whipped up around them got fiercer, but it actually it spurred them on. Okay, they weren't playing great, but they were sticking together and somehow grinding out the results. What do you think, Webby?
Yeah, I went onto YouTube and I had a look at some of the old clips, and there was a live feed of Bobby Robson talking to the people in the studio back in London, and he was mentioning about all this crap that was being pushed on them. You know, usually they don't mention that. You know, they just talk about, you know, how things are in the camp, but it, just for him to actually mention this, it was like, well, this is not good, is it?
And I think what's interesting over the years as well is how the players from that, particularly that squad, always talk about Robson and how he was, even under such intense pressure, when they kind of closed themselves off in that basin in Sardinia, and how he still managed to maintain a certain joviality and that sort of fatherly approach to the players when he could quite easily have gone the other way with them.
Yeah, I mean, you speak to them and they do all come across as being, seeing him as this kind of, you know, avuncular figure who'd make them chuckle a little bit with some of his quirks. I mean, things like saying Vicky Verky for vice versa, and the players all laugh about this now, and they laugh about, you know, how he'd always referred to the Germans and the war and so on. So he did make them laugh. But, you know, he was also a proper football man with a very good coach in Don Howe. And I think the siege mentality was probably intensified by the fact that the press, they didn't just go for Robson. They'd gone for Robson in the lead-up, but during the tournament, they then went for the England team with the hostess Isabella story, you know, claiming that some players had been up to shenanigans with, one of the local Italian women. So that really, you know, the hatches came down, you know, at that point, and there was that complete refusal to speak to the press.
I think it's a mark of his personality that when he then went to Holland, a couple of journalists who had been his fiercest critics came over, and Bobby Robson took them out for dinner and sat down and, you know, talked it over, essentially, you know, forgave them there and then and taught them through the last couple of years, and they left with an incredible impression of an absolute gentleman. And that was the thing about Bobby Robson, really, is that he was a great football manager, but he was just an even better bloke, wasn't he?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, for all sorts of reasons, England needed a big performance against the Dutch, and they got it. Robson took an uncharacteristic gamble and ditched his tried and trusted 4-4-2 formation and went with a sweeper system. Mark Wright of Derby County came in to fulfil that role. Out went Gary Stevens from right back, being switched for Paul Parker, who come in as a wing back. Peter Beardsley was dropped and not even on the bench. Barnes and Waddle remained trusted out wide. Holland made three changes from their first game and a slight tactical switch too. Incidentally, Peter Shilton's opposite number that night in the Dutch goal was Hans van Broeklin, who was his replacement in Nottingham Forest 8 years earlier when Shilton left the City Ground for Southampton. It was really bold by Bobby Robson under the circumstances, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think, I don't know, because of after the Ireland match, that they got a bit nervous about it. They got it sounds more like, should we try for the draw here? I don't know. They was, to me, it was just, it seemed like a lot of nerves was there.
Yeah, I think the one thing they did realise is that they needed more of a platform for their attacking players, didn't they?
And I think there was also a wariness, the Dutch had beaten them 3-1 in the Euros 2 years earlier. Tony Adams and Wright were kind of torn apart with Van Basten getting the hat-trick. So, to bring in another centre-back and, shore things up a little bit at the back. I mean, what one made me smile was the fact that Paul Parker hadn't played right back for 3 years, and suddenly he's, thrust into this this role as, the right wing back. It was a big thing. Aston Villa, I think, had played three at the back that year and finished runners up in the first division. That's not a complete red herring. Just to say, it wasn't. It for an England team was a big thing, but maybe it wasn't completely England in the dark ages, and that one of our best teams was playing that system.
But again, it's when you think in the situation that we were in, to do it then against Holland, who had been sort of a nemesis at that point, because not only had they whooped us in Germany at the European Championships in 88, but wasn't there a game also around 87, 88 when they came to Wembley and had given England a real footballing lesson and quite a bit of a chasing as well. So to do it at that time, under those circumstances, that was pretty ballsy.
It was, but England went out with a very different attitude to the Ireland game as well, though. It wasn't just the system, and nothing typified their approach then, Gazza snarling over the top of Ruud Gullit after he just cut through him on the edge of the penalty area. They really had the bit between the teeth, and I think it was a little bit of everything, wasn't it? It was the criticism after the Ireland game. It was playing a system that most of the squad, we're led to believe, really wanted to try and wanted to play. And I think there was a feeling that they wanted to prove something on the night, and they did.
Now, I remember watching the first half, and there was, after the Ireland game, it was everybody was watching thinking, oh, here we go again. They were expecting a bad performance, but then the game turned, didn't it?
Well, neither team could afford defeat, so tensions were high. The Netherlands began the more assured and looked the most threatening without really having England under the cosh. However, England grew in confidence as the game went on, no longer awestruck, it seemed, by their misfiring opponents, who still occasionally bared their teeth, but who were themselves beginning to dance to Paul Gascoigne's tune. The daft as a brush Geordie with dynamite in his boots was beginning to emerge as the tournament's breakout star and was beginning to justify the faith that Robson had showed in him. Timely too, as England lost Captain Marvel Brian Robson in this game, and it would have once been unthinkable that they could progress very far without him. But perhaps this was beginning of the end of his influence, where once he was our only hope, really. So let's quickly talk about these two great players, who were kind of at opposite ends of their England careers here, weren't they? We'll start off with Brian Robson. I think it's often forgotten, because England hadn't done so well throughout the 80s at major tournaments, just how good a player and how critical and pivotal he was to England, that Brian Robson was. He was probably, other than Lineker for a short period, our only world-class player. Would you agree?
Yeah. Yeah. And have you ever looked back over Brian Robson's England goals at any point? Because he had a habit of scoring not only important goals, but some absolutely stunning goals too. Mm. Absolutely brilliant goals. And he was perhaps the only player to emerge with any credit from Euro 88 as well.
Yeah.
Particularly in the Holland game, his goal there was just a sort of triumph of effort and energy over anything else. But he was, you're right, he was utterly brilliant, Brian Robson. But as we moved into the 90s, he just became this sort of perennially, oh, I can't even say it, always injured footballer that was this sort of once great force, wasn't he?
Yeah. Do you think he suffered too by the fact that he was, you know, the mainstay of that Manchester United team, but his career, his peak of his career had come when United were up and down and were considered mainly just a cup team?
Yeah, but I mean, he was the hero of a Manchester United team who won, you know, two FA Cup finals, when winning the cup final was the biggest day, you know, or the biggest thing in the calendar, really. So I mean, he was a hero of the time. He was the one with the column in Shoot magazine, as I remember, and the New Balance boots. But I mean, he was unlucky, you know, in Mexico 86 as well. You know, it was his injury which forced a reshuffle, which, you know, England ended up, you know, using as a platform, really, to go on to the quarters in Mexico. And, you know, ironically, the same thing happened again 4 years later in Italy.
Yeah, kind of does him disservice, really, doesn't it, to think that England actually benefited from his injuries?
Yeah.
And Gascoigne, of course, you know, I'm sure we're gonna talk about him a lot more as we go on. But it's crazy to think now that I think a lot of managers, England managers, since when any pressure has been brought upon them to take the next big thing along, and you think probably back to the likes of Rooney in Euro 2004 and Michael Owen before that in 1998, it didn't take a lot of lobbying in the press to convince either Glenn Hoddle in the case of Michael Owen or Sven-Goran Eriksson in the case of Rooney for them to have been chosen for those tournaments. But it was never guaranteed, despite Gascoigne's brilliance in the year or two before Italia 90. It wasn't an absolute cert that he was going to get picked, and he had to do a lot, really, in the end to convince Robson, didn't he?
The turning point was that Czechoslovakia game against the Czechoslovakia, where he was outstanding on the night, just involved in everything at Wembley, and then scored the goal late on, and that's when Bobby Robson came out and said, you know, we need two balls, one for him, one for the rest of the players and what have you. But he became almost impossible to drop from that moment on. But I think the moment in this game, and I don't know if you agree with this or not, Simon, but in the sort of world of Twitter and memes and vines and GIFs that we live in now, that Cruyff turn, Gascoigne's Cruyff turn in this game was basically his sort of effectively like his viral moment. It was the moment he arrived, and he just sort of just seemed to get better and better from that point on, because he did something that we were not used to seeing England players do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. When I rewatched this game, I mean, the first thing that struck me was that Steve Ball got the biggest cheer when they read the teams out before kickoff. So even at this point, Gazza wasn't the hero. You know, he wasn't the standard bearer. There was actually some people who thought maybe it's Steve Ball. But you know, as you say, I remember watching that moment at the time and thinking, you know, bloody hell, an England player's just done that against Holland. And it just didn't seem real. It was remarkable, and you know, it was just the starting point. I mean, you said you know, Gazza was this kind of late arrival as a guaranteed starter. I've got the TV Times from the preview of that World Cup, and Gary Lineker goes head to head with Sherry Lungi and sort of talking about their sort of dream World Cup 11, and she was the manageress, of course, so she would know her stuff. And in fact, she tips Gazza, and Gary Lineker says he's got enormous ability, but he's very young, and I'd opt for Brian Robson instead. So, you know, even Gary Lineker wasn't sure what was going to happen.
I mean, it's funny you mentioned about him being very young. He was 23, wasn't he? Which, when we think about being very young now, we you know, again, having had the likes of Rooney and Owen come through, 23 is almost like a veteran rather than a young player. But maybe that's the time we live in. We expect players to mature and be ready a lot sooner than we used to. Anyway, England always looked the more likely to score as the game went on. Gary Lineker's pace in particular troubled the Dutch defenders. A typical Pierce free kick kept Van Breukelen busy, which was created by Gazza's mazy run through the middle of the park. In the second half, Lineker did get the ball in the net after his initial close-range shot was well saved by the Dutch keeper, a move which again was started by Gazza in his own half and helped by the advanced wing-back play of Paul Parker, but it was ruled out for a handball. Lineker and Barnes then combined beautifully to open the Dutch defence up, only for the usually reliable Lineker to snatch at the chance with his left foot from about 12 yards out, and he screwed the ball wide when normally he would at least hit the target. Then came the most iconic moment of the match, which you guys have already talked about, when Gazza, played into the corner by a through ball, had the barefaced cheek to Cruyff turn Ronald Koeman. His cross just evaded Lineker at the far post, and it seemed that suddenly the pall of gloom that had been hanging over England began to lift. The Dutch, the supposedly superior Dutch, were certainly there for the taking. Another long bursting surge into the Dutch territory by the pumped up Gascoigne saw him fouled by Jan Wouters with just seconds remaining. Stuart Pearce's low drive from out on the right edge of the area arrowed into the bottom corner of the net. England celebrated, only for referee Zoran Petrovic to blow his whistle. His arm had been raised aloft for an indirect free kick, so the goal wouldn't count as no one else had touched it before it went in. In the aftermath, Hans van Breukelen calmly postured and pointed for the goal kick as if he had known all along what he was doing by leaving it alone. The giveaway being his poorly executed dive to stop the shot, which suggested otherwise, had the merest of touches off his body, of course would have meant a goal and a win for England and big trouble for Holland. As it was, both teams got something from the game to take forward into their respective final group matches, but for England, they took a whole lot more from it than a seriously blunted and out-of-sorts Dutch side did, which was the confidence that they could mix it with the big boys, and for them, the World Cup campaign could now really begin. I think really we can sum this up, or I feel we can sum this up, as England's turning point. Agreed?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there were headlines like, you know, new dawn, and, you know, this and this idea. Everybody sat up and thought, you know, we're actually not that bad.
And
yeah, the mood definitely did change. As I said before, that you know, at the beginning it was like here we go again, but by the end of the match it was going, hang on, there's something happening here, isn't there?
Yeah, and I would say that it wasn't necessarily only the impact it had on the players and certainly the fans, both though the few thousand that were in Sardinia and of course the millions back home, but I think absolutely the key to it was the fact that it re-energized Bobby Robson.
Yeah, I mean, to have taken that gamble and, you know, tried a different system, and for it to have worked, you know, under the, you know, with such high stakes, you know, you must, or he must have come out of that and thought, you know, with a real spring in his step and thought, you know, we're really onto something here now.
Right then, that's the football out of the way. Let's get down to the real fun stuff. Yes, the greatest of World Cup songs. Oh, bugger it. The greatest football song of them all, surely. June 16th marked the last full day that New Order's World in Motion, featuring Keith Allen and various members of the England squad, topped the UK music charts before being knocked off the top spot the following day by Elton John's Sacrifice, just as the team were warming up on their epic World Cup adventure. Sadly, none of the record's protagonists were up for talking about World in Motion when invited, but Simon, David and Webby are all chomping at the bit. It might not have had the feel-good sing-along schmaltz of Three Lions, but that, even accounting for the Lightning Seeds' involvement, was a bit of a novelty record. World in Motion was then, and is now, was seen as a real credible pop song, and it fitted right into the time, that time in British music when guitar and synth-based indie music was riding a crest of the wave. I'm probably guilty of this, and maybe a lot of us are. Do we give World in Motion and the type of record it was, and being, you know, and how it fitted into that summer and what England did, do we give it far too much importance?
No, I don't think so. I think you have to go back a bit, and Webby is the man who has who's done the serious research here, but it was a sort of sea change, because am I correct, Webby? You'll know better than me. 1988, was it We're Going All the Way?
Oh yes.
And it didn't even chart, did it?
No, that is it was Stockcake in Waterman behind that. It was a studio production. Or it is a horror. Don't even try to remember that one.
The only thing I really remember about that song is the dreadful appearance on Wogan, where half the team behind Bobby Robson were on, bizarrely, they were on exercise bikes or lifting weights whilst lip-syncing along to this dreadful tune. And that's what football songs had been. They'd just been novelties. This sort of... I don't think it's overstepping the mark to say this also helped move football away from the real darkness of the 1980s and the sort of widespread depression around the game. It lifted it. It suddenly, it was a game, it was something football related that was played out in sunshine. You know, it was a massive sort of cornerstone of what came after, I think.
No, I agree, because in 89, after the tragic events, that you know, they had the report that came out afterwards, and football recognised that it had to change itself, and you know, the fences came down, and the attitude changed. You know, the violence did stop, you know, with the fans, and the football culture, you know, the real football culture really possibly started around that year.
Yeah, and you've got to, like, sort of the 80s, the music in the 80s, you had sort of earlier on, you had punk, which was sort of rebelling against authority, and then you had synth and electronica, which was a lot of sort of middle class melancholy, really. World in Motion comes out of this musical boom that was more about, I mean, whatever you think of sort of drug culture and the music around it at that time, it was about letting go. And, you know, after this decade of, like, strikes and, you know, unemployment, it was, this whole music was born of a desire just to feel something else, just to feel happy. And World in Motion is, I personally think, is a great reflection of that, because it is so different to what's come before. It is very of its time, and yet it still feels a timeless piece of music. It's it's fair to say I quite like this song, lads.
The key thing, I think, is that it's not a typical football record, was it? I mean, that's the thing, that it's just basically a love song with, you know, football references thrown in, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we'll get into sort of how the lyrics came about and where the tune came from, but it sort of started life as a bit of music from a BBC Two show, and that New Order were fairly happy to use because it was a bit of new material that came along that was particularly easy for them to capitalise on. So you're right, it really wasn't a football song in any way, shape or form, even at its conception as a piece of music.
Well, let's go on to tell that story then. I mean, how did one of the world's leading indie bands, how were they co-opted into making this football record, even though it wasn't your archetypal football record, when the game was about as popular as a turd hidden behind a radiator?
Nice.
It came down to sort of, I mean, its real origin really comes down to one person, and that was the FA's press officer at the time, who was David Bloomfield, because he took the decision-making process away from the sort of older guard, and he wanted, to his credit, he always said he wanted to create a record that was a great record, not a great football record. And he knew there was only one person in the country that could do that and had the means to do that, and that was Tony Wilson. So they had a phone call about it, and Tony Wilson being Tony Wilson, he immediately seized upon the idea and looked at it from lots of different angles, not least of which was that the Hacienda was just absolutely bleeding money at the time, and they needed a way to try and earn some money for the record label. And then Wilson had to sell it to New Order, none of whom were interested in football. But they had this piece of music from, was it Reportage, where they, BBC, the programme they'd done some jingles for?
They'd done that, but the more direct reference was, there was a TV show in Northwest called Best of Marsh. I don't remember, it was on Granada in the late 80s.
Oh, yeah.
And they did the theme tune for that. And if you go on YouTube, you can find clips of the TV show. And you listen to the theme tune, and you can hear the basics for World in Motion song in there. So, you know, there was a link there with that.
Yeah, because one of the things New Order were very keen on was that this would be, they were only going to do it if they had to do as little work as possible. They really didn't want to put a massive amount of effort into it. So being able to cobble together the music as easily and as quickly as they did was a massive part of them actually getting on board with it. But then they hit a brick wall because none of them were into football and they really struggled to come up with any lyrics. So then that's where Keith Allen gets involved, doesn't he, Webby?
Yeah, I don't know. They must have been drinking in the same pub at the same time. I don't know how that this comedian, you know, from London, got involved with...
He was a Hacienda regular.
Oh, that's it.
Come up on the train and go to the Hacienda.
Oh, right. I could never put them two together. I was wondering how this met. But there you go.
Yeah, so, and they basically turned to him to write the lyrics, try and get some lyrics together, to which he responded by going on a massive drink and drug binge and turning up at the studio the day after, absolutely hungover, like you wouldn't believe, breathing out of his bum, took a load more cocaine to get himself going, and the first thing he set about doing with the lyrics was he desperately wanted to get a drug reference in there. So he came up with this Ears for England, England starts with E, we'll all be smiling when we're in Italy. And this didn't get past anyone. Everybody knew what he was trying to do. But he still claims to this day, and I'm not totally convinced by this. I think this is just a happy accident. But he says that the line "it's one-on-one" is a reference to the phrase "are you on one," as in "are you on a pill." I think that's a coincidence. I don't actually think he managed to sneak that in as a drug reference, because it just, I don't know, it doesn't particularly sit right to me. But so they got together most of the lyrics, and then like loads more drink and drugs imbibed, etc. New Order again slightly passive towards the song in that they really didn't want to put much effort into it, but they managed to get the lyrics together in some sort of form, and then they left a gap in the song because they came up with the idea of doing a rap, and that's a whole nother story.
Well, indeed, and a great tune though World in Motion undoubtedly is, we can't really talk about it without mentioning the John Barnes rap. Apparently, Barnes won a rap battle with Paul Gascoigne, Peter Beardsley and Chris Waddle for the honour of performing it on the track. Jesus Christ, can you imagine the alternative had Barnes been off that day? Although Waddle, and soon after Italia 90, Gazza were musically unleashed on the public at other times, personally I've seen John Barnes rap live in recent times, although it wasn't the World in Motion rap, it was actually Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang, so at least he's versatile. But that, of course, makes him the obvious contender. And he'd also done bits for the Anfield Rap, Liverpool's FA Cup final song in 1988. This is such an iconic section of this or any other song. Why is it so endearing? New Order were cool enough, and Keith Allen, although he was relatively unknown, he seemed like a bit of a geezer. But you had Barnes, who was cool. Well, he was Jamaican, of course, and he was probably the best player we had at the time. I don't think it's nostalgia at play here, is it, that makes us look back at the rap in particular with such fond eyes, because it was received really well, even though it was by a footballer, even back in 1990.
Well, yeah, they turned up on the day, and John Barnes was basically the only one who could do it in a way that could be understood, because by the time Gazza went into their booth, he'd had three bottles of free champagne, never once asking for a glass. He'd done them all straight out of the bottle. They were all on the clock because they were going to open a shop later in the day, a branch of Burton's. But they had all basically Steve McMahon, Des Walker, Chris Waddle, John Barnes, Paul Gascoigne, and Peter Beardsley turned up and all received £1,000 in cash for turning up in the morning. But there really, when you think about those names, there really was only one person there who could perform this and could pull this off, because can you imagine Peter Beardsley rapping more than any others? But the original idea was that they wanted to do it as a group thing, so it was going to be slightly slowed down, and this was in effect going to be your England squad contribution to the song. But they realised pretty quickly, when only sort of six of them turned up, that wasn't going to work. So they put this rap together, and to be fair to Keith Allen and also Liverpool's Craig Johnson, who was there on the day and helped with some of the lyrics, because he of course wrote he co-wrote the Anfield rap before this. He helped get the lyrics together, and it's just, when you actually listen to the lyrics, I'm sure Simon you'd agree with me, it's actually really good, isn't it? It's not, I'm not saying that in an ironic way or anything like that, it's genuinely good.
Yeah, no, I mean, at the time it was genuinely good. It was exciting to see an England song like this, much as I liked this time more than any other time. but you know, it was a great song, and as you say, with great lyrics. I mean, you mentioned Craig Johnson, who I believe came up with the line, "We ain't no hooligans, this ain't a football song." And you know, but the fact is, something which is so iconic, so memorable, which has endured, sort of came together in such a kind of off the cuff, you know, sort of alcohol drug fueled afternoon or morning or whatever it was. It's incredible sort of hearing the making of it process, which sounds pretty shambolic, and yet they produce something which, you know, is still loved 30 years on.
Yeah, there's the whole thing comes full circle as well, it's worth saying. Sorry, I know I'm talking a lot, but it's worth just mentioning that the video was almost the most shambolic part of it all, because New Order weren't particularly bothered. So bizarrely, Bernard decides to turn up wearing a full Elvis suit just for a laugh, and there is a shot of that in the video. That's the second football ground he'd been to in the day, because he turned up at the wrong one first time. They go to record the rap with John Barnes, who they don't go to the trouble of even getting him an England shirt. So he's recording in the video in his red Liverpool training top with an Adidas logo. And also Keith Allen was there, and he spent the entire recording, he was out of his face basically, and he spent the entire video recording just trying to make John Barnes laugh, which is why you get that moment where he turns slightly to his side and only just manages to stop himself from corpsing. So yeah, the whole thing is just, it's a miracle that it is as coherent and is as great piece of music as it really is.
Well, I'd have loved to have been a fly on the wall when we were discussing the lyrics, because I heard Peter Hook say that they were kind of squabbling over whether to have a Rivadeci it's 1-1 or Buongiorno it's 1-1, and I couldn't imagine it now if it was Buongiorno or, you know, some Ciao, it's 1-1. They just happened to get the right thing all the way through.
Yeah. And the other thing is, and again, Webby, you'll know this better than me, but there's a remix that became like an anthem in gay clubs everywhere, wasn't there?
Yeah, I can't remember which one it is, but was that Wetherill? I can't remember who remixed it now. But yeah, I'm just looking it up now as you're talking to me.
It's the No a la Valencia.
Oh, remix, yes. I think. Yes, that one, yeah.
Well, World in Motion remains as colourful and important piece of the Italia 90 tapestry in England as any goal or result is. And of course, it was a great song, and it was so relevant to what went on in that month of the summer of 1990. But if we think about other World Cup songs that came after it, has it actually left legacy on anything that's come after it?
Perhaps its real legacy is the fact that every England song after that point has been compared to it, hasn't it? Arguably not very favourably.
Yeah. Maybe it was the culmination of it, or this and the Three Lions song. It was almost the culmination of a tradition, or, you know, we had the cup final songs as well, which has died out. You know, just as we don't really have Christmas records anymore, every Christmas record you hear now seems to have been done in the 70s and 80s, at least in the supermarket. But yeah, I don't know, why do people no longer want to bother? I mean, I think Ian McCulloch did one, didn't he, for France 98 with the England squad.
Yeah, and he got the Spice Girls on board, didn't he? And it was, it didn't quite work. But I think World in Motion sort of legitimised a football song in a way that was never really bettered. And then Three Lions took that on and legitimised a football anthem, something that could transfer to the terraces. And like, I don't want to say perfection, but it is that thing of sort of how do you improve on perfection. There's not, it'd be very, very tough to sit down and come up with a song if your remit was it has to be as good as Three Lions or it has to be as good as World in Motion, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, perhaps football just doesn't lend itself well to being a subject for serious music artists. And speaking of which, we can't talk about the good 1990 World Cup songs without highlighting some of the other mostly terrible tunes that were dreamed up, recorded and released around the world to celebrate Italia 90. Gents, before recording this podcast, I set you the task of picking out some of the worst and most unusual examples. What have you managed to dig up for our listening pleasure? Dave, I'll start with you and your first choice, please.
Well, we've talked about England's effort, so I think we should probably talk about Scotland's, which was Say It With Pride. We say it with pride. Lions shall roar in the sun. Light up my eyes. A feeling that can't be denied. A nation so small.
Tell us all about Say It With Pride.
Well, this was it's by nominally by the official Scotland 1990 World Cup squad, but there's a bit of a travelling Wilburys feel with Scottish musicians, as their guest vocalists on it are there's Fish from Marillion, James Grant from Love and Money, Donny Munro from Run Rig, Jimmy O'Neill from The Silencers, and a couple of members of Deacon Blue played on the record as well. It's rubbish. I can't really think of another way to say it. It sounds like an advertising jingle for a university that has allowed the students to put the advert together, is the best way I can describe it. It's trying to be anthemic and it never really gets there. And the lyrics are, to say they're on the nose, you know, the lion shall roar, we will walk through that door to it all. It's just a bit, it's not very good. And like, emotion is filling up my eyes, the lion shall roar in the sun. The whole thing just doesn't work and is perhaps befitting of Scotland's campaign in 1990 in the end.
Can I just add something? In defence of Scotland, there was really no way that get any better than 1982, and We Have a Dream, with John Gordon Sinclair and B.A. Robertson.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
I'm in complete agreement there. That's probably one of my all-time top 10 favourite songs.
All-time football?
Yes. Oh, yeah, all-time football's favourite songs. Yeah, definitely.
Is that the one with Gordon Sinclair basically doing narration into the song?
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, I remember that.
Which was quite clever, wasn't it, really, for what everything else was happening at the time.
Yeah.
I think a key thing here is that, like with Keith Allen and the World in Motion song, is that they've got B.A. Robinson was behind that, and he was a comedian. You know, a comedian seems to be good at writing football songs for some reason.
Yeah, there's a theme there, yeah.
Okay, Simon, what's the first one you've picked out for us?
Well, I've gone for Costa Rica, and whatever I say cannot do justice to simply going on YouTube and watching the video. It's called Lo Daremos Todo, We'll Give It Our All. And the video begins with them doing some kind of warm-up exercises on what seems to be a hotel lawn. And then they're then in, you know, some kind of a television studio in their Lotto Shell suits. Lots of very thick moustaches, lots of beer. occasionally the footballers end up on the kind of keyboards and guitars, not in the kind of cool way the Lee Sharp played a guitar on Come On You Reds, but in a really kind of cheesy way befitting the song. Now, I've got to say, I deferred to a friend of mine who is a talented music writer, and he sums it up as a cruise ship Spanish language interpretation of Back Home, with Osale Mio stranded in the middle. So, and it's possibly even better than that. So, I'd check it out on YouTube right away.
Right, well, now Simon's giving it the big build-up. Let's have a quick listen to that. Webby, what musical treat have you stumbled on for us?
Well, it's one. It's by. It was a single that was actually released in Germany. I never discovered it until you mentioned to me. It's something I completely missed. The name of the act is Digitalia, and the song is called Coppa del Mondo, in brackets, World Cup Italia.
Right, let's have a quick listen to that then.
World Cup Italia.
I don't know if you've seen, if you go on Discogs, which everybody knows about, it's probably the best site to discover information about records. And I found a scan of the back of the single, because, you know, I went to try to find out who recorded it, and the complete mystery, you know, these musicians, I think it must be made up names, obviously, because it says music and lyrics is by Dirk Heine and Marcus Chaft. Seriously, that's what it says. The keyboards were by Dirk Heine and Marcus Chaft, and it says sounds crappy.
Well, having heard this myself, I can verify that it certainly sounds crappy. It sounds like a Poundland copy of Ride on Time by Black Box, doesn't it?
Oh yes, definitely. I mean, I don't know if Casio released a keyboard that year that had that one setting you pressed and everything just sounded the same.
No doubt a few tourists in Italy would have bopped the night away into various nightclubs in Milan and Rome to that one, because it was very much of that Technotronic and Black Box, as I've already said. It had that vibe about it, didn't it?
Yeah, and so I thought it was an Italian release, but no, it was all West German. So that's the weirdest thing.
David, seconds out, round two in our music hall of shame, which begins with you. What have you got next?
It is Marco van Basten and Frank Rijkaard singing Prepares to Murder pronunciation. Het is fin in Ital Tizin, which means it's nice to be in Italy.
I'm going to inflict the song on all of you now, and this really is about as dire as it gets.
Ik sta hier in het zonnetje, in een stadionnetje, heel ver van huis, maar ik voel me hier wel thuis.
We moeten zo weer spelen, niks punten delen.
David, what on earth inspired two great football players with seemingly bags of cash, probably wanting for nothing in life? They're playing for AC Milan, they're European champions both at club and internationally. What on earth possesses them to make this record that basically sounds like the pair of them have been kicked out of some CD bar down the red light district of Amsterdam at 4 a.m, pissed, and just singing along to any old crap they'd heard on the jukebox that night?
Yeah, I mean, I can't stress that enough, really. Both of them sound drunk. Neither of them can actually sing, which is usually a prerequisite to putting a record together. It sounds like a early 70s Eurovision entry that got about 14 points overall, sort of mixed with maybe a French folk song. It's the opposite of a football song as well, because it's got a really long, sprawling chorus that doesn't seem to fit with the rest of the song. The only thing I can say is that it sounds like something that may have been on for a few seconds of Holiday 85 with Cliff Mitchell-Moore as he wandered through an Amsterdam street.
Yeah, certainly not good. Okay, Simon, over to you for your second choice, please.
I'm taking you to Czechoslovakia.
Thank you.
The song, yeah, you're welcome. Now, again, pronunciation apologies in advance to any of our listeners in Czech Republic or Slovakia. At Zizhou Football is the actual name of the song, although I think the recurring kind of lyrics are Dame Dame Gol. Which I think is referring to a goal somewhere, but it's rubbish, and it's by three fellows called Wagner, Frantisek, and Czech, who look possibly like the three least likely pop stars of all time. I mean, I remember Joe Fagan on Top of the Pops singing "That's Living All Right."
Yeah.
Imagine three of those and multiply it by about 3,000, and you get the unlikeliness of these three. But they were quite big in Czechoslovakia, it seems. They did this song, which includes stanzas of the three national anthems of the opponents in the group, so that there's a little bit of US, Austrian, and Italian anthems played by some sort of very, very tinny Casio keyboard. But this is actually their second big football song. 2 years earlier, they'd done their own little take on Ole Ole Ole, probably not very original, but it has a video with Panenka in it and a load of other players from that time. And it got censored. Sorry to ramble on here, but a little bit of a factoid here. It got censored because one of the players originally referenced in the song, basically he fled Czechoslovakia and to try and play for Derby County, Noflicek. So instead of the song saying Noflicek and Hasek, they'd have dropped his name out of it. So he might have been the only Italianated footballer who had his name cut out of a song because he'd fled the country.
Well, let's have a little bit of a listen to that, and it's the proof that even living behind the Iron Curtain for so long hadn't left the Czechoslovak music scene immune to shit electro football songs. So Webby finishes off with something respectable, at least.
Well, if I say to you, put them under pressure, I think everybody will know that one. It's the Republic of Ireland, you know, in 1990. I mean, the Irish people, once they qualify for a major European championship, they all want to sing. Everybody sings. But the most famous song is Put 'Em Under Pressure. It was produced by Larry Mullen from U2, and it had a member of Clannad on the intro of the song.
Oh, yeah, it's Enya, isn't it?
No, it was Moya Brennan from Clannad.
Oh, okay. Yeah, oh, well, they all sound the same to me. Right, well, let's put a clip on so you can at least have a blast of this fantastic opening prog rock riff.
We've qualified for the World Cup. Go and compete.
Right, I mean, that's a fantastic riff there. We've got a nice bit of rock, we've got a bit of Clannad, we've got the sort of sing-along part, and we've also got Jack Charlton in there with his broad Gashington accent, with comments about game, different games. So, Webby, how where would you rank this amongst the rest of the Italian 90 songs we've talked about? Of course, not really putting it up against World in Motion, which we know is peerless.
No, but I think it's because they have that key, the simple chorus that you're getting on the terrace, you know, that ole, 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 ole. You know, I think it started from them.
Well, I mean, I think we're going to have to give some dishonourable mentions to some of the songs that we haven't talked about in depth here. For example, there's Yugoslavia's Attempt by Snezana Babic, better known as Snecky, with Ti Saluto Italia, which is 2 minutes 19 of utter garbage. You'd expect to hear this sort of jingly-jangly accordion tripe on any 1970s or 80s package holiday. And I doubt this had any positive impact on the Yugoslav team if they ever listened to it on their Walkmans. And then there's Sweden's Aftershave and Football's Landslaget. Again, excuse the poor pronunciation, anybody listening in Sweden, that with Ciao Ciao Italia. I mean, that could have been the music to a travel agent's TV ad, or a half-assed B-side to any Stock, Aitken and Waterman act. An absolute gem, however, and hopefully you're all going to agree with me here, comes from English indie rockers Pop Will Eat Itself with Touched by the Hand of Cicciolina. Cicciolina, incidentally, is an interesting lady about whom we'll hear more in just a second. This is about as 1990 as it comes, with keyboard, drum beats and a nice brass thread running through it to give it the carnival feel. You can imagine putting on your baggy flares, paisley shirts and having your floppy haircut in any club of the day and twisting your melon to this. It's got overdubs of England match commentary throughout too. It's dancey, ravery, and it's perhaps cocking a snook toward New Order for selling themselves out to the establishment. And it's even got a slice of opera in there to tick all the boxes. Rounding off our dissection of the Italia 90 related audiovisual art scene, Rich Nelson, curator at the brilliant Betamax Video Club podcast, who is to Vincere R as Barry Norman was to the BBC's Film 90, reviews a movie that you probably didn't see at the cinema that summer. Certainly not at your local Odeon multiplex, you didn't anyway.
Hi, this is Rich Nelson of Betamax Video Club, and you're joining me for a very special edition about Cicciolina e Moana di Mondiali, or Sex World Cup. This was a film that came out in the build-up to the 1990 World Cup, and it had a very particular plotline, the sort that you don't get in the official FIFA films, such as the previous efforts brought to you by Sean Connery or Michael Caine. Now, on the copy I had, which was rather heavily dubbed in German, it doesn't take a genius to work out what the plot is. A very low-rent lookalike of Franz Beckenbauer and a very passable Paolo Maldini speak, probably in Italian, to two very attractive young ladies, Of course, the talking doesn't go on for too long. In fact, it just took 3 minutes for the first nipple to pop out. Two blondes, Paolo Maldini and Franz Beckenbauer, what more could anyone ask? But this one has a very special plot. Italy, in the build-up to Italia 90, are very concerned about their prospects when up against their key rivals, Argentina, West Germany and the Netherlands. So the two blonde ladies go around a little tour of Europe, and indeed South America, to sabotage their players with the only weapon that they know how, sex, and lots of it. Quite graphic, in fact. I couldn't make out who the lookalike of the Germany player was, but this West German wearing that famous Adidas Germany replica shirt certainly made the most of his encounter with an Italian and a fine finish into the top corner. Now, some of you may remember Diego Maradona from the previous World Cup. Well, his representative in this was none other than Ron Jeremy. A very good lookalike, in fact. The hair, the physique. Last but not least, we had Ruud Gullit. Now, of course, Ruud Gullit, famous for the dreadlocks and bringing total football indeed, as he had two encounters with the Italian ladies as they attempted to bring about the end of what was then the European Player of the Year. Now, I'm not sure of the CVs of any of these actors before. I don't know if I hadn't seen Diego Does Dallas or anything like that. But as a film, I mean, it certainly brings to life the story and what lengths Italy would go to. Of course, the film was interspersed with stock footage of the Spain 82 World Cup, which Italy, of course, won. Now, looking back in hindsight, all we needed was Toto Scilacci to maybe step up, grow a blonde wig and do his thing. But, yeah, he still did the business, and of course these ladies is too. Now, whether they went on to win any sort of prize at the end, a golden boot or golden boob for that, but still, it was a lovely film. Marks out of 10, I'd give it one.
We're going to squeeze one listener question in today, and it comes from @followtrawler, who says Costa Rica's achievements are often overlooked, and asks, what story from Italia 90 do you think deserves more love and attention than it ever gets? Simon, I'll start with you.
Blimey. I mean, Costa Rica is a great one, I agree. And, you know, there's actually been a film made about it, just to underline what it means to the people of you know, that country, who've never been anywhere near a World Cup. Sorry, can somebody else take over while I get inspiration? I'll jump back in.
I'm trying to think now.
Tough one, isn't
it? Just give me a second.
Inspired by my choice of the terrible Czech music before. I mean, the Czechoslovakia story, getting to the quarterfinals. Not the greatest team, but just the fact that they had that player Novacek who'd fled the country to play for Robert Maxwell's Derby County, and he actually got into England on a Bolivian passport, having spent 6 months living in a house owned by the Guinness family in Spain. I mean, his story in itself is one of the great kind of individual sagas in the lead up to that tournament, so maybe I go for that one.
David, did you come up with something?
I think the only thing that comes to mind, really, that there's just no chance of it ever sort of slightly going under the radar ever again, just because of the way we cover football now and we know everything about everything, is just how massive it was for Brazil to play Argentina in a knockout game. It was the game itself wasn't great, and it was lit up really by a sort of moment of genius in the ball from Maradona to Canizia, and the goal was an excellent goal. But it seems incredible, really, that I think, is that the only time? That's definitely the only time I think they've met in a World Cup.
Yeah, good one. I think we'd all have to, you know, scurry off to Google to double check that, but you could be right.
But it's just, you know, if that happened in the next World Cup, say, that would be just incredible at any stage, you know, to see Brazil and Argentina play a one-off knockout, winner-takes-all game. And, yeah, I, without sounding dramatic, I hope I live to see it again, really.
Well, we've come to fact time again. Romario and Bebeto, who were both on the bench against Costa Rica today, formed a legendary strike partnership that helped fire Brazil to their 1994 World Cup triumph. And after their long and successful playing careers wound down to their respective conclusions by the end of the noughties, the two later paired up again in the world of politics, and more specifically in the political arena of Rio de Janeiro, where both had played for a number of the city's biggest clubs. However, back in 2014, their long-standing friendship came under immense pressure when they were pitched into direct opposition. Romario had very outspoken views on Brazil hosting that year's World Cup finals due to the vast expenditure and alleged corruption that took place. Bebeto was very much on the other side of the fence, working on the organising committee and as an ambassador for the tournament. They were able to work through it though, and in 2017, Romario, now a prominent state senator in the country's National Congress, persuaded Bebeto, a member of Rio de Janeiro's Legislative Assembly, to switch allegiances and join his centrist Podemos party. Podemos meaning "We Can," taking inspiration from Barack Obama's "Yes We Can" slogan, on a ticket to modernise democracy in Brazil and eliminate corruption. Phew, I think we're all going to need a little lie down after this. But before we retire, I'll thank today's guests. Simon, thank you very much for being with us again. Remind us of your Twitter, please, so people can follow you.
Thanks for having me again. It's at Simon22PH.
Brilliant. Dave, thank you for being here. How can our lovely listeners get hold of you on the old socials?
It's at David Hartrick, which is HARTRICK.
Fantastic. And Webby, thanks so much for coming onto the pod. Please point everyone towards the website and Twitter, please.
The website's Football and Music, and the Twitter handle is Footy and Music, Footy IE.
Excellent. And also our thanks to Rich Nelson for sitting through more than an hour of Ron Jeremy and co and muddying his internet browser history in the name of research. You can follow the brilliant Betamax Video Club on Twitter at BetamaxPod, and you can download episodes via all the usual channels. You can give us a shout on Twitter or Instagram too at VinceR90, that's V-I-N-C-E-R-A, because we've got all natter about Italian 90 there, and we're available across all sorts of podcast platforms, including all the best ones, so you'll find us easily enough, and please don't forget to point others in our direction. You are coming back tomorrow, right? Good, because we'll be talking about the immovable Irish, the enigmatic Spanish, and getting stuck into referees and standards of officiating at Italian 90. Ta-ra!